This is Mary Todd Lincoln. President Lincoln said that you could fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time. But he always said that you can never fool Professor Buzzkill, so don't even try. Let's join the good professor as he talks history, busts myths, and takes names. I'm getting a little hot and bothered just thinking about it.
Okay, here we are with Professor Sarah Myloff. Professor, how are you? Thanks for coming on the show.
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
It's so nice to be here, and I had to walk across the UVA campus a long way, and I started wheezing, and I started to remember all my great-aunts and great-uncles who were wheezing because of cigarettes and their cigarette addiction. You're very kind to come on the show today and talk about your new book, The Cigarette, A Political History, and I found it absolutely gripping because of so many things I learned. But I thought today we could talk a little bit about that famous 1964 Surgeon General's report. It was sort of a big, you know, boulder in the ocean of health and smoking in the United States anyway. January 1964, the Surgeon General makes a public report on the dangers of smoking. Was it the first official report of smoking hazards?
Actually, no. There was a report issued the previous decade in 1957 by Eisenhower Surgeon General, a man named Leroy Burney. That report assessed more than a dozen studies from a handful of countries, basically the state of the knowledge, the state of the field as it existed at the time. And what that report found was still quite significant. It found that lung cancer was 5 to 15 times more likely among smokers than in non-smokers. It found that quitting would reduce the likelihood of cancer. But we don't talk about this report. We don't hear about this report because ultimately the Public Health Service, which was behind the report, basically soft-pedaled its findings so as not to ruffle the feathers of organized medicine. It didn't want to go too far in articulating what public health as opposed to individual doctors ought to counsel when it came time to say whether or not somebody should smoke.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Oh, and crucially, and this is also why we don't hear much about the 57 report, in the early 1950s, the tobacco industry already had begun to conceive of its disinformation apparatus, beginning as early as 1953. In 1957, folks in public health knew that their resources were no match for those of the tobacco industry. And so it wasn't until 1964 where the construction of the report was a much more meticulously crafted political document did the Surgeon General really have the opportunity to kind of match the public relations apparatus of the tobacco industry at the time.
Oh, I see. So you have this problem because you can set out all the information, but of course, if the tobacco industry, you know, tries to negate it completely with all their resources, it's not going to go anywhere.
Precisely, which is why the construction of the 1964 report, by which I mean the actual selection of committee members, the way in which its release was staged on a Saturday so as to have to minimize disruption in the stock market the least amount, but to maximize coverage in the Sunday papers the greatest amount, why that was so significant and really skillfully thought through by the Surgeon General at the time, a man by the name of Luther Terry.
Okay, so Buzzkillers will put a link to the video of this happening, or the old video of this happening. All of this stuff was done not just whenever they could. They actually planned and said, hey, we better do it on Saturday. We better do this. We better do that, because they knew what the public reaction, industrial reaction, things like that would be.
Every aspect of the 64 report was meticulously thought through. From the selection of 10 committee members, five of whom were smokers, five of whom were non-smokers, to authorizing public health agencies like the Heart and Lung Association, the Cancer Society, the Tuberculosis Association, later known as the Lung Association, with veto power over any potential member of the committee, to allowing the Tobacco Institute, the tobacco lobby, veto power over any potential member of the committee. Every single one of these choices was made with the goal in mind of producing a politically pristine document that could later be used to authorize regulation of cigarettes.
And I noticed, and this is one of the great quotes in the book, Throughout 1963, the panel convened in a room at the National Library of Medicine. The air was thick with smoke, and the table was covered in papers and ashtrays. Even the Surgeon General's report was the product of a smoke-filled room.
Well, this is exactly the point, that it was Terry's great genius to realize that by having
Surgeon General Terry.
Surgeon General Terry's great genius to realize that he could preempt the inevitable objections of the tobacco industry by giving them veto power and by mandating that half of the participants in the process themselves would be smokers. You couldn't say that the committee itself was biased if half of the people who began the process in 1962 were themselves smokers. I should note, though, that by the end of the process, only one remained smoking, and 1 year after the report was issued, he himself was diagnosed with lung cancer.
Oh, so while they were going through all the science and all the data and everything, a lot of these people dropped their habit, or at least tried to.
Terry himself switched from being a cigarette smoker to smoking only an occasional pipe.
And I noticed that in some of the newspaper reports of what happened, and in your upcoming book, you talked about how the room was cleared, or the room was pasted with posters saying no smoking, no smoking all around. Perhaps the first instance of that happening in Washington.
But this is in reference to the auditorium in which the report was itself released on Saturday, January 9th, 1964. Inside that auditorium, no smoking signs were hastily affixed to the walls inside the auditorium.
I shouldn't laugh. This is a deadly issue, but still.
Deadly serious, and there was probably a good number of reporters in the room who were themselves scared into dropping the habit after reading the report, which of course stated in no uncertain terms that smokers had a 9- to 10-fold risk for developing lung cancer as opposed to non-smokers, among other significant findings.
9- to 10-fold, that's enormous. That's not just saying, twice as much or...
No, and what subsequent research has proven is that actually smokers are more likely to die, that heart disease is actually the greater killer of smokers than lung cancer, though lung cancer was the focus of the initial report.
So what was the immediate reaction out in the country? I mean, here I hear stories of course, the signs go up in the press conference room, and then there were other people covering it outside who gradually started putting their cigarettes out as the Surgeon General went on. But what happens out in, wide America?
Well, initially after the report is released, tobacco sales decline by about 20% during the first half of 1964. But by 1965, people seem to have forgotten, or perhaps the addiction was simply too strong, and sales have rebound by the middle of the 1960s. You don't start to see really steady declines of nearly 1% a year in reduction in smoking prevalence until the early 1970s. So even though the kind of education and knowledge is certainly out there, and it is sinking in, almost double the number of people agree with the idea that cigarettes cause cancer by the late 1960s than agreed with that idea a decade earlier in the 1950s. So, people do have an awareness, but awareness is not all it takes to break not only a personal addiction, but a powerful social habit.
Because after all, many of the buzzkillers won't know because they weren't born. It used to be almost unusual at parties not to smoke, or there not to be a billion ashtrays around in the smoke-filled rooms. That was why they're called smoke-filled rooms.
Yeah, I mean, the social default was acceptance of smoking. Now, the actual figures were never greater than 50%, and that was only among men. It was not among women. So, smoking prevalence when the report came out was about 42% overall in the population. But 42% in a room still gives you the feeling that that is the social default.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And the smoke is going everywhere.
Right. The smoke is ubiquitous, even if the number of people who are actually engaging in the habit are not.
Yeah. I mean, for instance, my parents were very anti-smoking and didn't have ashtrays in the house as sort of a sign to people when they had house parties, don't light up. But that was very, very rare.
It was a form of protest.
Yeah. Oh, I never thought it was a form of. I'll have to tell them over at Christmas dinner, that they were early protesters. Well, so apart from the obvious addictions and people having to go back to their cigarettes, what happens more broadly in cigarette economy, if you will?
So cigarette sales fall by about 20% during the first half of 1964. Mm-hmm. Though it's important to remember that this is only in comparison to 1963, which had been a banner year for the industry.
Okay.
Actually, that year, Americans smoked enough cigarettes for every American adult to have more than half a pack a day. So it dips, but it's dipping in comparison to an all-time high. People were afraid. This is why the sales of cigarettes dip. The headlines were obviously scary. And the Surgeon General's report was kind of the lead story on numerous nightly newscasts and radio broadcasts.
That's right. Yeah.
But by 65, really, the industry had rebounded. It reported record sales and the highest profits in the industry. The figures of adult smoking prevalence don't really start to budge in a major way until the 1970s, until the early 1970s. So that kind of steady decline in per capita consumption, which we've seen since then, does not happen really until 1973, when it begins to decline at a rate of nearly a percentage point annually.
So did this sort of cause doctors or convince doctors or convince health experts to say, look, this really, really is addictive because it's not dropping at the rates we thought it would?
Well, certainly when it came to what doctors thought, the Surgeon General's report was pivotal.
Right.
There were very few doctors who did not counsel their patients to quit smoking after the report came out. And that actually was pretty significant, because in the 1950s, doctors were some of the smokingest Americans.
Smokingest, I like that.
around. So in terms of one-on-one counseling, absolutely. Now, as to the question about addiction, which is clearly how we understand the cigarette today and the language that we use to describe the effect of nicotine today, the 64 report actually hedged on the language of addiction. It said that smoking should be viewed as a habituation rather than an addictive behavior.
And so what does habituation mean rather than addiction?
Yeah, so in the 1960s, the idea of addiction centered a lot more around the social pathologies or problems that came from engaging in certain behaviors. So one would be addicted to alcohol or heroin if it ruined your professional life, your work, or your family life. And because society was centered around the acceptability of smoking, cigarettes simply were not understood as addictive in quite the same way. At least, and this is crucial, not by all of the members of the Surgeon General's report.
Yeah.
Remember, the idea of this document was to produce something that was going to hold up to political, even more than or equal to scientific scrutiny.
Yeah,
so every
right.
single member of that panel who came from all different backgrounds had to agree on the language. So they deliberately did not weigh in on whether or not the cigarette should be labeled addictive as that term was used at the time.
Okay, so we know that the smoking rebounded after the Surgeon General comes out with his report. So, and the addiction becomes clear. And we'll talk about more about the social effects of that and what happens after 1960 when we get back from this station ID break. Okay, we're back with Professor Sarah Mylov on talking about the 1964 Surgeon General's report about the dangers of smoking and then what happened, how long it took to percolate throughout the country and on and on and on. The first thing it seems to me would be, Professor, that the government agencies would jump on the bandwagon and say, oh, you know, this is something bad. We need to do something about this. What happens?
Well, in a sense, that is what happens. The Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, was the first agency to jump into the fray after the report comes out. And that agency proposed a very strongly worded label that it proposed would appear on cigarette packages, but also on TV and radio advertisements. Once the FTC proposed that, Congress sprung into action with a watered-down proposal of its own.
Yeah.
So what ultimately passes in response to the Surgeon General's report is a 1965 Labeling Act that substituted the FTC's strong wording And the FTC's package wording would have been, smoking is a health hazard. The Surgeon General has found that cigarette smoking contributes to mortality from disease and the overall death rate. So there's nothing ambiguous there.
Yeah, that's
it
very strong.
A health hazard.
Yeah.
It contributes to mortality, and the word death would have appeared on all cigarette packages. Yeah. It substitutes that language with the blander, cigarette smoking may be hazardous to your health.
Mm.
At the same time, Congress also prevents the FTC from regulating cigarettes for the next 4 years. So for many advocates for public health and for the public interest more generally, this episode highlighted why such activists in the 60s and 70s looked toward regulatory agencies rather than Congress for the representation of non-commercial interests.
Oh, okay, okay. So I see that because it's never going to get through Congress because of tobacco lobby and whatnot, but the regulatory agencies might have enough power on their own in the executive branch.
Exactly. So during the mid-1960s, in particular, tobacco had quite a grip on Congress. Remember, this is a time of Democratic domination of both houses of Congress.
Mm-hmm. And Democratic Party, yeah.
Exactly. And for LBJ specifically, he wanted to do nothing to further antagonize sitting congressmen from Southern states.
Yeah, we should remind the buzzkillers that now it's very different, but the South was solidly Democratic back then, and the way it's almost solidly Republican now, and that's all. A lot of it is tobacco.
Absolutely. Nearly all tobacco state representatives were Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, Joseph Califano, who was an advisor to Johnson, and ironically would take on the industry when Califano later served as Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare under Carter, and would lose his job basically because he came out too strongly against tobacco, and the tobacco industry sought and got his scalp. Califano recalled that there was only so much we could do to take on the South in explaining why Johnson wasn't more forthright in basically issuing any kind of statement in support of the Surgeon General's report.
Oh, so it's not just the tobacco industry, and it's not just the fact that it's the tobacco farmer, the strength of tobacco farmers throughout the South politically. It's that they're also Democrats in Johnson's party, so Johnson can't turn against them, so to speak, as strongly as you might expect.
Even more than that, some of Johnson's closest intimates were representatives of the tobacco industry. I mean, in a way, it's very fitting. You know, Johnson himself was the master of the smoke-filled room, and he operated quite comfortably in situations where well-organized representatives of industry worked with the government to make regulations.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, he was close with Abe Fortas, a Washington lawyer. Fortas represented Philip Morris. And 2 weeks after the Surgeon General's report, 2 weeks after the Cigarette Labeling Act is passed, something Fortas really wanted to happen because, remember, it was a watered down bill.
Yeah.
Johnson nominated Fortas to the Supreme Court. Perhaps even more telling was Johnson's relationship with a man, a very famous Democratic politico and insider named Earl Clements, who was a Kentucky Democrat who actually served as party whip in the Senate when Johnson ruled the Senate in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
During the 60s, Clements was the president of the Tobacco Institute, so the actual tobacco lobby.
Goodness me.
And Clements' daughter was actually Lady Bird Johnson's press secretary. So Johnson was very comfortable operating in this kind of clubby insider Washington world, and indeed he was threatened in all sorts of arenas by the idea of the public interest coming into Washington and disrupting normal strategies of representation.
Do we know if Northern Democrats were different than the Southern? I mean, were they pushing Johnson we need to health that we need to put regulations on, and then Southern Democrats were rebelling, so to speak?
I don't think that in 1965, the constituency in Congress for stronger labeling was that widespread. The real exception to that is an Oregon senator named Maureen Neuberger, who was very early in condemning the way in which Congress was, you know, proclaimed fealty to the tobacco industry. But it was, it would have been unusual. Mm. She was unusual in the Senate for holding that position.
Yes, this part of your book, this section, one of the chapters, you call "Regulating Among Friends." I thought, well, that was a wonderful way of explaining how, you know, this, how difficult it must have been, even if you were very anti-tobacco, to try to get this through, all the get this approved by all the people that you knew and worked with all the time.
The power brokers in Congress of the 1960s mm-hmm. were all steeped in the ways of Washington at the time, mm-hmm. which very much channeled power through well-established organizations and institutions.
Yeah.
And the Tobacco Institute was one of those organizations and institutions. Right. There was not a robust public interest or public health lobby at the time yet. So it took a lot of activism, a lot of creative activism to break in to Washington. And indeed, the most successful types of activism as related to anti-tobacco actually didn't go through Congress at all. They went through agencies and they occurred at the local level precisely because of tobacco's power within Congress.
Well, I certainly remember when, you know, and this was as late as the 80s, some states and some locales weren't as forward thinking in restricting smoking, public places. You know, California was maybe the first to go totally smoke free, and then New York City was famously lagging behind. You know, that was it wasn't a national ban at all.
Oh, there's still not a national
ban.
Indoor smoking is still regulated by a kind of a patchwork of local and state laws, as well as just voluntary decisions by private businesses.
Well, that sort of really is the almost the Uber definition of something that's regulating among friends. They're dealing with trying to deal with people whose livelihoods are based on this, but then of course you've got to deal with the public interest.
Absolutely.
I think lots of people assume that smoking habits and restrictions and laws kind of happened overnight, but what you've been telling us is that it took a long time. It was very complicated. Wasn't just immediate when the Surgeon General's report came out. How long did it actually take to happen? How long? Obviously, 2019. You know, that's a long time from 1968. But when did smoking really become unusual in public?
I'd say by the mid 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
In certain areas of the country, smoking goes from being the social default, that is, one can expect to smoke in a number of places, to not being stigmatized per se, but a smoker might have to question whether or not he can engage in his habit publicly. For example, by the early 1970s, smoking restrictions are in place on airplanes. So you can't smoke anywhere you want in an airplane. You have to sit in the smoking section. Similar restrictions also exist on buses. And by the mid-1970s, hundreds of cities around the country have passed local ordinances that restrict, not ban, but restrict where smoking can occur within a city in terms of shared public spaces. So parks, theaters, libraries, places like that.
So where do we stand today? It seems that especially when, you know, you spend a lot of time in other places in Europe and other places, that America was the first place to really go smoke free. Where does it kind of stand today?
So when you look at overall trends in cigarette consumption, there's a lot to be proud of in terms of this story. Peak consumption 65 years ago stood at more than 40% of the population. In 2016, that figure was at about 16%. So a real tremendous reduction in smoking. Now, along the way, smoking habits have become significantly more classed. That is to say, now one can predict who smokes by looking to a great extent at the level of education and one's income. So at mid-century, smoking certainly did not have the kind of lower class connotation certainly has today. Today, though, still 40 million Americans smoke cigarettes. It's still the top cause of preventable death in the United States.
40 million, wow.
40 million. And each year, you know, upwards of 480,000 Americans die every year of smoking-related disease. And that still accounts for about a fifth of all deaths every year. So we can look back with great satisfaction. This is certainly a story of a public health triumph, but it's not, it's nothing to be taken for granted, and there's still progress that can that remains to be seen.
Okay, we should tell buzzkillers out there that your book, your new book, The Cigarette, A Political History, which is a great way to approach it, The Cigarette, A Political History, is coming out by Harvard University Press later this year.
Yes, I'm glad you liked the title. It wasn't my original idea, but I give great credit to the press for coming up with that one.
I was going
to
call it Puffing in Politics, but I didn't know whether that
No, I think they like to avoid puns.
Well, it's going to be in the Buzzkill bookshelf as soon as we can get the pre-order, you know, approval or whatever it is from Harvard University Press. So all that remains is for me to say thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
And to tell the buzzkillers out there, don't smoke, and we'll talk to you next week.